Hey, everybody. It's Roll Around the Barrel. Today, no interview. We're going to do something a little different. I know everybody's bummed about the whole baseball season getting pushed back 2 weeks on the schedule, and spring training is gone. So although vintage baseball this time will commence as planned, I haven't seen any events canceled due to COVID-19. But it's a day-by-day situation, so today everything's a go, as far as I know. Today I'm going to hit 5 or 6 different topics for you and give you a little scratch on that baseball itch. We'll see how this goes. If you guys don't like what I do on this episode, I won't do it anymore. I'll just stick with the interviews, but this is not replacing an interview. This is just extra content. So with that being said, let's talk about some baseball. First thing I want to get into is a player from the 1880s by the name of Cap Anson. Very polarizing figure. Very racist figure. You know, when people bring up Ty Cobb, they often think what a terrible person and what a racist Ty Cobb was. But that's actually not the case. But in this case, true. So before I get into the Cap Anson career, I'd like to read to you from A Sip of Sports a little article they did about Cap Anson's racism. And then we'll get more into his baseball career. He was born in Marshall, Iowa on April 17, 1952. He was the first white child born in that town. Baseball fever swept the nation in the 1860s, and he got caught up in the excitement. He was playing for the Marshalltown team in 1870, and then he was discovered by Albert Spalding and signed to his Forest City team, and this is 19 years old. So he played for the Forest City, the Rockford Forest Cities, actually, for $66 a month at the age of 19. Forest City would become one of the charter members of the National Association, the first major league in 1871, and Anson was their third baseman. He actually stood 6 feet tall and weighed around 227 during his playing career. Certainly did at this time. With the collapse of the Forest City team in 1872, Anson signed with the Philadelphia Athletics, thus beginning a career amongst the greatest of all time. The National Association fell apart after the 75 season, mainly due to 4 key players from the powerhouse Boston Red Stockings and the Philadelphia club jumping their contracts to sign with the Chicago White Stockings. The association couldn't enforce the contracts, thus falling apart and allowing the birth of the National League. Beginning in 1876, Chicago baseball and Adrian Anson would begin a journey which would last until 1898. He would be named captain of the team in 1879 at the age of 26, and that is when he got his moniker of Cap and was known for Cat as Cap Anson for the rest of his life. Before that, his real name was Adrian Constantine Anson. Adrian Anson. A true visionary, he became a dominant figure in the Major League Baseball. He was the first manager to actively pursue the best players from around the country, sign them, thus creating a powerhouse squad. This forced other teams in the league to adopt the same course, thrusting the National League to Major League status. He was the first to employ platooning, to give signals from the bench, to call for the hit and run, and in short, he was responsible for the most strategic changes in the game in the early years of the National League. Unfortunately, he was one of the people most responsible for segregation of baseball. Anson was bombastic, conceited, and a racist, and in 1884, Chicago had an exhibition game against the Toledo Blue Stockings of the American Association. Toledo had a college-educated, well-spoken catcher by the name of Moses Fleetwood Walker, who happened to be black. Anson insisted that the Toledo manager, Charlie Morton, remove Walker from the game. Anson threatened to pull his team off the field, but Morton would not relent. Threatened Anson to play the game or leave, So Anson stayed and played the game, but he began a campaign to ban colored ball players. In the months that followed, several leagues did ban colored players. It became very confusing. Nobody was sure which leagues allowed colored players and which leagues didn't. It came to a head again in July of 1887 when Chicago traveled to Newark to play an exhibition game against the International League's Newark Little Giants. The Little Giants had a pitcher, George Stovey, who the National League New York Giants were looking to sign. Stovey was black, and Anson again refused to take the field. This time the opponent relented, and Stovey was removed from the game. Still, there were no rules banning black players from signing major league contracts. The teams just refused to sign them. Anson gets a bad rap as the man who segregated baseball. Yes, he was a racist and preferred not to play against colored players, but he was a baseball player first. Charlie Morton proved that he would back down if his baseball life was threatened. The problem with baseball was too many players agreed with Anson, and nobody had the guts to stand up to the practice until after World War II. It wasn't an Anson problem. It was a baseball disgrace. And it wasn't until 1946 when Branch Rickey initiated his great experiment and signed Jackie Robinson that baseball would be integrated. Not only baseball, but the country owes them both more than we can ever repay. So, a couple things. It says he got a bad rap. Well, I mean, he really didn't. But those were the times. But Moses Fleetwood Walker, first black baseball player, way before Jackie Robinson. And so let's go to Cap Anson's career. He played 27 seasons. He was the captain manager in 1879 of the Chicago White Stockings. He was, along with Albert Spalding, credited with the start of spring training because he took his club to Hot Springs, Arkansas in 1886, and that kind of started the boom of spring training. He won two batting titles from in 1881 and in 1888, and he also led the league in RBI seven times. Now, another controversial thing about Cap Anson is how many hits did he have over his career, because he's widely thought of as the first guy to go over 3,000 hits. But sometimes in the statistics, they're not counting that season with the Rockford Four Cities. So it depends on what publication you look up, but you're going to see a lot of different numbers. No one can seem to agree on how many hits he had. A renowned baseball historian by the name of John Tattersall went back and went through all documentation and came up with the fact that Cap Anson only has 2,995 hits. So there's so many different numbers out there. Take it for what it's worth. He finished his career with a .334 batting average. He hit over 324 times. His career teams went like Rockford, Four Cities one season, Philadelphia Athletics for four seasons, and then he played and managed the Chicago White Stockings / Colts for 22 seasons. And they had a name change in the middle of his tenure there. He was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1939. He died on April 14th, 1922, of a glandular ailment. That funeral was paid for by the National League. And he currently sits in Oak Woods Cemetery in Chicago, Illinois. Yes, he's a very polarizing figure. Did a lot of good and some bad. He ended up being, after he retired from baseball, he was the city clerk of Chicago for a couple of years. Ran for sheriff, I believe, of Chicago, and lost that. And he did go on and do some acting on the vaudeville stage, which actually, from what I can find with some baseball players I've looked up, wasn't uncommon, actually. So that is Cap Anson, or Adrian Constantine Anson. That's our player review for this week. And now we're going to move on to today in baseball history. Of course, these are the Ides of March. We'll get into that later. But today on March 15th in baseball history, 1945, with wartime travel restrictions still in effect, the Dodgers opened spring training at Bear Mountain, New York, with 15 players in camp. Seven teams, the Browns, Tigers, Reds, Indians, Cubs, Pirates, and White Sox, are training in Indiana, the most of any state. The Red Sox are at Tufts College, while the Braves are prepping at the Choate School in Connecticut. Also in 1945, Burt Shepard, a one-legged veteran of the war, tries out as a pitcher for the Senators, and he actually appeared in a game. The symbol of wartime baseball, outfielder Pete Gray of the Browns would field and bat with only one arm. 1975, the Dodgers signed free agent pitcher Juan Marichal. After two poor outings, Marichal would retire on April 17th, leaving a career record of 243 and 142, 52 shutouts and a 2.89 ERA. In 1977, the Pirates traded outfielders Tony Armas and Mitchell Page and four pitchers, including Rick Langford, to the A's for second baseman Phil Garner, Tommy Helms, and pitcher Chris Batten. And in 1978, A's traded Vita Blue to the Giants for seven players and an estimated $390,000 in cash. All right, in this segment, we're going to talk about the COVID player of the week. COVID-19, and today's number 19 is Robin Yount. Robin Yount had an incredible career. You can definitely look up all of his statistics, and I am not going to bore you with all that, as I already did that with Cap Anson. I just wanted to talk about one thing that happened to Robin Yount during his career, an interesting story. He was actually thinking about retiring at a very young age. It was during 1978. He was actually thinking about taking up professional golf because he was tired of the Brewers losing all of the time. And they had to really talk him into this. It took him a long time to get him back on the field. And when they didn't think he was coming back, they called up Paul Molitor from Class A. So Paul Molitor actually took over as a shortstop of the Milwaukee Brewers, and then Robin Yount, his demands were met, and he returned to the team. And Molitor was moved over to second base from shortstop. But if Robin Yount wouldn't have threatened to quit and become a professional golfer and ask for more money and all that stuff, if that wouldn't have happened, what would have been of Paul Molitor's career? That's very interesting to think about. But once again, look up all of Robin Yount's achievements. He finished with 3,142 hits, 251 home runs, .285 average. He never played for any other team except the Milwaukee Brewers. Robin is still alive and kicking and coaching. I believe he's still affiliated with the Brewers in some hitting capacity in the minors. Another interesting thing is he was drafted third in the baseball draft, and Dave Winfield was drafted fourth. So those two draft picks right there worked out pretty good. Today in history, it is the Ides of March. So we're going to go back to 44 BC. Beware the Ides of March. The augur Spurinna had warned some days earlier, but Julius Caesar had brushed him aside. Was he not, at 55, the most powerful man in the civilized world? For 5 years, he had been dictator after having decisively defeated the coalition of nobles, including the great Pompey, who had tried to destroy him. Caesar knew there were senators who hated him, who, in fact, were plotting to kill him, but so sure he was of his position, of the awe, and perhaps he hoped the love, in which he was held, that he had dismissed the troop of Spanish bodyguards that had normally escorted him. So at mid-morning, Caesar set off for Pompey's theater. Why do these things always happen with a theater? What's the deal? Where the Senate was meeting. En route, a friend handed him a note with the details of the assassination plot, but Caesar simply put it with the other letters he was carrying, having no time to read it. Entering the theater, he saw Spurinna among the crowd. The Ides of March have come, he mocked. Yes, replied the augur, but they have not yet gone. Caesar took his seat, quickly to be surrounded by conspirators who pretended to be paying their respects. One seized him by the shoulder, and Caesar shook him off. As he turned away, one of the Casca brothers, central to the conspiracy, stabbed him with just below the throat. Grabbing Casca's arm, Caesar stabbed it with his stylus and tried to escape the ring of murderers now surrounding him. But suddenly, the great man realized it was hopeless. Since Casca's first thrust had not, he had not uttered a word. But when he saw his protege, Marcus Brutus, among his assassins, he murmured in Greek, "You too, my child." He then drew the top of his toga over his face while letting the lower part fall, so he would die with both legs covered. The murderers struck out in a frenzied attack, sometimes wounding each other in their eagerness for the slaughter. 23 knife blows struck home as Caesar stood there defenseless before he fell dead to the floor. So died the greatest of all Romans, perhaps according to McCully, the greatest of all men. But he had changed the world. He replaced the corrupt and incompetent rule of the Roman nobility with an autocracy that lasted for half a millennium in the West and 1,500 years in the East. And he gave to France the Latin civilization that replaced tribal barbarianism, and that one's lasted to this day. As for the assassins, virtually all were killed within 3 years of Caesar's murder, and like Marcus Brutus, committed suicide. History is a special place for Brutus. Caesar had been his mother's lover and had helped him all of his life, but nonetheless, 5 years before the assassination, Brutus joined Pompey's army against Caesar. Even so, Caesar pardoned him and appointed him governor of the Cisalpine Gaul. Oh, I'm going to get letters. For his treachery in his Inferno, Dante places him in the lower circle of hell alongside Judas, hanging from Satan's mouth. Well, isn't that special? Okay, here's a quick story about a rule change that happened because somebody stole first base. The man was Herman Schaefer, and he was well known as a baseball trickster and tactician during his years of Major League Baseball from 1901 to 1918. He played with the Chicago Cubs, the Detroit Tigers, the Washington Senators, the New York Pepper, not the New York, the Newark Pepper, the New York Yankees, and the Cleveland Indians. During a game in 1911, Schaefer was standing on first with a teammate on third when he attempted the double steal, hoping to draw a throw from the catcher and allowing his teammate to score from third. The catcher didn't make the throw before the next pitch. Schaefer took off again, but this time was running back towards first. So according to Detroit outfielder Davy Jones, the play was successful. The catcher threw and the runner came home safe. 2 years later, after Schaefer left the game and following his death, Rule 7.01I was established in Major League Baseball in 1920 that states a player is out if he has required legal possession of a base. He runs the bases in reverse order for the purpose of confusing the defense or making a travesty of the game. So, if you didn't understand that, this guy on third and he's on first, he steals second, hoping to draw a throw, so the guy from third happens all the time in baseball, right? Well, the catcher didn't throw it, so he ends up on second. Also happens all the time in baseball. So, on the next pitch, he runs back to first, trying to confuse the catcher and the catcher fell for it, throwing to first, run scores. That's how that happened. And now I'm going to end you with an interesting story about how famed bank robber John Dillinger was once a professional baseball player. Everyone has heard of the infamous bank robber John Dillinger, his jaunty Clark Gable mustache, daring escapes from jail, the lady in red turning him into the G-Men, his death in a hail of bullets outside the Biograph Theater in Chicago. He's one of those bad guys that are uniquely American, totally ruthless and misguided, but so easy to find yourself rooting for. It's a dangerous thing pulling for the bad guy, but boy, does it ever make a crook like Dillinger more interesting when you find out he was a crack ball player in his youth and how the game actually had a big role in turning him down the path that led to his bloody demise outside that Biograph Theater at the age of 31. Like most red-blooded American boys of the time, young John Dillinger was an avid fan of the national pastime. He followed the Chicago Cubs and, in between, bullying smaller kids, petty theft, hard partying. Dillinger played baseball. His quick speed on the local Indiana sandlots earned him the nickname the Jackrabbit. After too many run-ins with the local police, Dillinger enlisted in the U.S. Navy in 1922 but deserted a few months later. He slinked home to his father's home in Martinsville, Indiana, and married a 16-year-old girl by the name of Burl. Trying to get his life back on track, Dillinger tried his hand at a few different jobs, but failed miserably. His marriage to teenage Burl had also started to fall apart. The only success he seemed to have was on the baseball diamond. His skills were such that local teams paid him to play ball for them, and throughout the summer of 1924, the cash for play kept he and his young wife afloat. Dillinger's steady team was the Martinsville Athletics. He was the star shortstop, and the team-high batting average earned him a $25 award from the local Old Hickory Furniture Company. Behind the hitting of John Dillinger, the Athletics won the 1924 League Championship. After the season ended, the former shortstop found himself in dire straits with baseball, money drying up. While normal young men would have used their local athletic notoriety as a stepping stone to a respectable career, Dillinger did the opposite. Instead of utilizing the connections he made to pursue honest employment, Dillinger chose on a fellow he met on the ball field to launch him into the big leagues of professional crime. League umpire and low-life criminal Edgar Singleton set up John Dillinger's first armed robbery. Hopefully... This is crazy. Hopefully Singleton's arbiter skills were better than his heist planning skills, because the robbery of an elderly grocery store owner was so badly botched it was almost comical. While Singleton waited in the getaway car, Dillinger attacked the store's owner with a metal bolt wrapped in a cloth. The strapping young Dillinger got his ass whipped by the old man, and during the fight, the would-be robber's gun went off, hitting the old man in the foot. The mastermind and the getaway driver lost his nerve and sped off, leaving the beaten Dillinger to hoof it home on his own. To no one's surprise, both men were quickly apprehended. Now a professional criminal, Dillinger was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison, of which he served 9. But again, baseball played a pivotal role in his life. Prison officials recognized his baseball playing skills, and he quickly became the star ball player on the Indiana State Reformatory Ball Club. He followed his cubbies through the newspaper and took part in baseball betting pools. The constant denial of his parole eventually made him bitter. When he was transferred to a much harsher Indiana State prison in Michigan City, he convinced himself it was because the prison wanted him to play shortstop on their team, though some sources say he asked for the move himself. Instead of playing ball, when the season came around, Dillinger turned his efforts to learning all he could do about honing his criminal skills. With all the hardened thieves and cutthroats in Michigan City, he had no shortage of tutors. The John Dillinger that emerged from prison in 1933 was now a well-educated criminal. He instantly embarked on a bank-robbing tear that both shocked and fascinated the nation. Crisscrossing the country and living constantly on the run, Dillinger still took time to follow the Cubs. In between robberies, he was said to have attended more than a few ball games at Wrigley Field. In fact, before one game in August 1933, the bank robber was pointed out to outfielder Babe Herman as he sat with a group in the left field box seats. The Cubs' great catcher, Gabby Hartnett, told how the Chicago police apparently knew of Dillinger's presence at Wrigley Field, yet did nothing to turn him into the feds. The following season, he continued to attend games, especially after he had a crude plastic surgery done to alter his easily recognizable face. Hiding out in Chicago, Dillinger went to see the Cubs get edged out by Cincinnati 4-3 on June 8th. In a story that made newspapers nationwide, he was in the upper deck at the June 26th game as they defeated Brooklyn 5-2. A guy sitting a few seats away named Robert Volk happened to have met Dillinger the year before when he stole a car during a prison getaway. He instantly recognized the arch criminal, and much to his chagrin, the robber recognized him too. He got up and sat close to the terrified man. After sitting in an awkward silence for a while, Volk turned and said, "This is getting into a habit," to which the country's most wanted man replied, "It certainly is." Shaking his hand, Dillinger introduced himself as Jimmy Lawrence and departed during the seventh inning stretch. Apparently undaunted by the close call, he returned to Wrigley Field again a few days later and watched the Pirates get pounded by the Cubbies 12-3. After the victory over Pittsburgh, the Clubs left on an extended road trip and were still out of town when Dillinger decided to pass the time by catching a movie at the Biograph Theater. Of course, we all know what happened after that. If he was a White Sox fan, he might have lived a little longer. They were in town that afternoon playing a doubleheader against the Yankees. Okay, so there you go. John Dillinger. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening today. I just wanted to throw some content out there. This is not a very long episode. It's only going to run about a half an hour. And we'll see how this goes. I hope everybody's safe out there. I hope everybody's washing their hands and, you know, the whole contact within 6 feet. This thing is spreading. It's spread way more than we even know. So let's just be diligent with our cleanliness and our respect towards other people. And let's not forget about baseball because it's still happening in our minds. And we will come back on the air with an interview this coming Wednesday with Matt Stone of California. I have a lot more interviews lined up, but we can also throw some other material at you if it helps you while you're sitting at home trying to stay safe. So thanks again for listening. This has been Matt, the Barrel Roller Bernard. Hoping everybody is well out there. Semper Fi to my son, Ashton. We'll see you next time.